The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and a big warm welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krutowski. On this week's show,
there's an article that came out in The Guardian while we were rehearsing talking about how Second Life was going to start using the Oculus Rift technology. And it's kind of like, I'm telling you, this isn't this isn't science fiction. This is coming down the pipes.
The Nether is a new play by award-winning LA-based playwright Jennifer Haley, which delves into the moral complexity of virtual worlds. Jennifer joins me in the studio to talk about the darker side, and I mean darker side, of our digital lives. Also this week, we look at the privacy implications of network devices and ask if it's impossible to expect your light bulbs, your smoke detectors, your thermostats, your printers, and your washing machines not to spy on you now that they're connected to the Internet of Things. If you thought controversial taxi service Uber was all about you rating the driver, well, it goes both ways. The driver is rating you too. And Google announced its ambition to use its technological resources to understand human health. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio this week are Guardian technology reporters Alex Hearn and Samuel Gibbs, and Guardian's head of technology, Jemima Kish. Welcome to you all. Do you all have a thing in your home that's connected to the internet that is not your computer?
Yes, I do. I have a Chromecast, so that's connected to the computer and spies on my watching habits.
It spies on everything. Alex Hearn, do you have anything connected?
Yes, quite a lot.
I think we're talking to super users
trying to top them up in my head. It doesn't fit on what the fingers of one hand, certainly.
Dang. And Jemima?
Well, I've just bought my kids their first box of Little Bits, which are amazing, like Lego circuit board components. So pretty soon I fully expect everything in our house to be connected to something or other, and certainly the internet.
Little Bits are awesome. I'm going to bring some Little Bits in for your boys. They will love that because I have a few spare.
Woohoo!
Anyway, the Internet of Things is the idea that all our devices will at some point be networked and build up data to allow everything from smart shoes to the forever promised smart fridge to be more responsive to your individual needs. It all sounds good to me and to my fridge, but there's a catch. If your entire house and your workplace and most of your personal devices are all networked and assessing your every need, how can you keep that data and, by extension, your life private? Can you go off-piste in such a world? Is it possible to retain part of your life that's not measured bit by bit? Well, two experts wrote about this conundrum in The Guardian this week. Julia Powles is from St. John's College, Cambridge, and is a PhD student in law, specializing in the interactions between law, science, and technology. And joining Julia is Jat Singh, who's a computer scientist and senior research associate, also at St. John's College, and his focus is on security and privacy in networked computer systems. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Hi there.
Hello. Well, the first question that I have for you guys is privacy dead?
I wouldn't say dead yet, but it's certainly gone through cycles of suffering. I think, you know, you sort of see people, you know, giving stuff away, seeing it being used in various ways, and then you're seeing some people fight back. So it seems to be sort of an oscillation sort of issue, I'd say.
Julia, how long has it been suffering?
Well, I think that we have been, I think we're only catching up on awareness. So perhaps one of the arguments we make is that there's quite a lot of obscurity in how we transact information and particularly our privacy. And we're now seeing some pressure points with it and some pushback. So really, this is the same generally in privacy over time. Privacy is actually quite a recent emergence in English law and tends to respond to changes in the external environment rather than in the actual transactions that we're doing with information.
One of the things that you argued in this piece on The Guardian is that the physical nature of the internet, should change the privacy debate compared with what we're considering right now as privacy breaches in a Web 2 world. But the technologies that are connected will become mundane and invisible. And so therefore, that kind of physical element of thinking about something as tracking us will also become mundane and invisible. So in the future, I can imagine that a smart fridge or a smart light bulb or smart shoes will think about it in just the same way as our web browser histories now, won't we?
This is probably true, but I think the difference is that at the moment, the way that, you know, web services operate is that you're actually dealing with something that the company has constructed. So if you're using a particular service, all your data is going to that service, into some servers, being used by that. I think the difference with the Internet of Things, or where they're more tangible objects in the real world, is that you're essentially the owner of, say, your space in the house. So you'll know what you have available in that house. So if you start seeing data cropping up, you know, relating to your fridge usage or whatever, you sort of have an indication of where that data might have come from. So in other words, you can see by nature of the physical world, and quite often physical environments, which you're familiar with and control, where that data would have been collected and where it might have come from. So that helps to sort of raise the awareness of actually where that data might be used, as opposed to just, you know, randomly typing things into websites and then over years seeing, you know, some sort of aggregation of your likes based on that.
It seems quite logical that a lot of the problems and the challenges in online privacy come out of the fact that many of these businesses are businesses. They're organisations designed to make money, and one of the currencies they do that with is with data, which obviously brings up kind of privacy implications. But maybe that there is the potential there, if not for new businesses to kind of manage our online presence and our kind of our quite valuable pool of personal data, then maybe it should almost be a not-for-profit business. Do you think there's scope for an organisation or a business to be run on that kind of precedent?
Well, I think that one aspect could be that you could have third-party trusted parties that could, you know, manage data on your behalf. Though the other approach is that the nature of the Internet of Things is that it will depend on how things develop. If everything's done within, say, a vertical silo, for example, if everything in your home is connected via Google services, then I think we'll keep seeing what we've seen before. But to really get the most out of Internet of Things, you want things to work across different providers. You want, you know, your television or whatever to talk to your phone, or whatever you want talking to each other, to work across vendors, across services, across providers, across platforms. And that will necessarily need some sort of collaboration, some sort of control, some sort of standards, those sorts of things to actually make the whole thing work. So if it goes that way, and if privacy or various, you know, security concerns can be built into that mechanism, then there may be a chance for, you know, privacy concerns to be part and parcel of the services that are offered. But it really depends on how things will develop. And we see with all the new buyouts by the big players, you know, as soon as a Internet of Things company comes up, they're being bought out. You're seeing that they're trying to create these walled gardens. So I guess it's a case of we'll have to wait and see.
Jat, extending that, whose responsibility is it to ensure that these security mechanisms are in place?
Well, ultimately, I think that the law tends to move slowly. These issues will be, you know, compounded. They're very new. It's not clear exactly. There'll be a clear understanding. So I think that it might have to be a case that sort of consumers talk in that sort of sense. And again, it comes back to that tangibility point that Julia raised earlier. If people can see that, oh, it's actually data relating to my house or my usage of this particular appliance, or, you know, some data coming directly out of my bathroom, then you have a better sense of, you know, what might be leaking that data, how it might be being used, as opposed to just saying, I'm using my computer and, you know, potentially using a billion different providers and don't know where that data is coming or going to.
Julia, what was your response to the news that Google had bought Nest? Because there were a lot of people who had a kind of knee-jerk reaction to that, in thinking that, you know, oh my God, Google has had kind of overview of all our data in the real world, and now they're going to have oversight of data inside our own homes. But is that an overreaction?
Well, I think that, I mean, as Jat said, the trend that every time something comes up, it's snapped up, and that this space is being watched before we're even aware of it again, is quite concerning. But I think if services can be very deliberately, you know, if we can appreciate what the scope is of that information, it's not that sometimes we actually really would like this information to be aggregated at scale, and it gives us all sorts of new capacity that we wouldn't have otherwise. But it's really the knowledge of why connect anything? I mean, your fridge works perfectly, and I think Jat and I both have the same frustration. Somehow this the main protagonist of this Internet of Things has been the completely uncreative fridge. But nevertheless, I mean, a fridge doesn't... We have limits on what we think a fridge should do and should send, and same with a smoke alarm. But if it's done in a way that is really serving broader needs, I think you would have a lot of appreciation for having great data flows.
What are the two or three points that kind of general, I don't want to say consumers because we're citizens really, but what are the two or three points of concern that citizens should be asking themselves when they're looking at services that might potentially share their data in this way? Because I'm sort of thinking about it from a consumer point of view, if you like. Yeah. As a shopper, I'd actually really like an app that could connect to the Jamie Oliver app and then not just tell me what the ingredients are, but, you know, connect that to my online shopping order, deliver it to my house, and then my fridge reminds me when I need to cook with those ingredients before they go off.
I think one aspect would be that, say, if you like the app, again, it's that sort of notion is that, you know, are you paying, are you the consumer or are you the product? So, you know, if an app comes for free, then you could say that's got to be paid for somehow. So again, you know, then that sort of issue might be hidden in the opaque sort of terms and conditions. And then, you know, it's the same sort of problem compounded. But then again, if, you know, that's only the only app which you've authorized to deal with your fridge is this particular application, then you might be able to, well, at least over time, see what data flows are sort of coming out of that, because you sort of have better control over, okay, this is my fridge, this is how it's being used, and this is where I'm seeing my data ended up being used.
Jat, you are the computer scientist of the pair, but Julia, I'm actually interested in the legal implications from your perspective at this intersection between code and law. Why should we be worried about who's creating these devices beyond the sort of the data that they're collecting about us? What is it about the code that we should be considering?
Well, I mean, I was just thinking, reflecting back on the purchasing of devices and what should we be insisting on, Jemima's question. And partly, we've seen companies that have made commitments to consumers about what they will do. I think it was it Moves and other apps that have promised that they wouldn't aggregate data, and now they've been acquired by Facebook and Google and others, and that's changing. So there's some consumer law issues there, and there can be some pushback. I think we desperately need standards in the Internet of Things. There's international discussions, but they tend to be quite closed. And then we're seeing aggregations of particular consortia of tech companies that are lining up. And those discussions really need to be open. They need to be engaged with, I think, again, like with things being, people not being quite aware of what's happening, we're a bit behind the eight ball. But those discussions are critical so that we have interoperable technologies, and we have ones that are making sure that consumer interests are first.
Thanks to Julia Powles and Jat Singh. You can follow their research at cambridge-code.org and read their recent article about privacy and the Internet of Things at theguardian.com/technology. Key to Google's success is using sophisticated algorithmic strategies to advertise to you what you may not already know you need. Clever computer. You liked that, didn't you, Alex?
I did like that.
Thank you very much. This week, Samuel Gibbs wrote a story on The Guardian's site about how the philosophy behind giving us what we don't know we want will soon be applied to research funded by Google that could eventually let us know before we know, if you see what I mean, that we're about to get ill. Clever. No? I'm looking over at Alex. Samuel, what? What?
So, yes. So, basically, this is the baseline study. And it is being... I mean, it is a Google study in the fact that the person in charge of it is a Google bot. And it's also being using Google's money. But this is really much more than just a kind of like a new Google product. This is basically Google's moonshot division, Google X, investing in raw science. And it's very exciting. I mean, from
it's
my
very exciting if you're a scientist, Sam. Yes.
I have to say, I would have absolutely killed to be part of this in my days as a scientist. Anyway, so what they're really doing, and what is different from most people and most studies, is they're actually studying the healthy, which seems kind of, I don't know, obtuse. You know, why would you look at somebody healthy? Why would you do research on somebody healthy? Well, the idea is that we're going beyond, yes, I feel okay, and yes, all my joints work and things like that, to the biochemical signature of what is a healthy human being. So they're looking at kind of like the, both they're looking at the genomes, but they're also looking at the chemistry of your body when everything is functioning correctly. And the idea, as in the name, baseline, is to give a baseline of body chemistry to the point at which something is slightly different, then you have something to measure it against, and therefore you can pinpoint when something goes wrong.
Now, this assumes that that a baseline reading will in fact be a baseline reading. What if somebody already has an underlying condition that they may not know about?
This is very early stages. At the moment, they're doing it's only a 175 person pilot, and by the end of the year, they're going to be expanding it to around about 400.
And this is 175 people from which background?
The general public from the US. So I can't tell you where it is, because they won't tell us, because they don't want to bias the study. But in this case, what they're basically doing is a physical exam of the people, plus blood and saliva. So what they're going to do is DNA sequencing. So they're going to sequence the whole genome of every participant, and they're going to be monitoring them based on their habits and lifestyle. So the idea is you compare, you know, so do they smoke, do they drink, do they do lots of exercise, and what the underlying chemistry of their body reflects. So it's a very interesting kind of look way beyond we've ever looked before.
But why does Google want to do this? And this doesn't sound like a piece of research which is based in technology or using technology to analyse and understand human beings or their health. And yes, it sounds a lot more robust than Google flu trends. But why? This is a whole new sphere of expertise, isn't it?
It is. And it's difficult to see what's really in it for Google.
Oh, God, come on. I know.
But
combine that with the behavioural stuff that they think that they have.
We have to somewhat isolate this from what we think of as Google proper, because this is Google X. They're not planning, they've said outright this is not designed to go straight into a product.
It
almost looks altruistic from the outside. Of course, they've got to have some sort of motive. I mean, Larry Page has been championing the opening of medical data, and people have been very against it. You know, they're worried about it, and I to be fair, it's totally appropriate to be worried about the release of personal data, because there's all sorts of pitfalls and things that you can get into, profiling, that kind of thing, you do not want to go into. So I think it's basically Google voting with its money and with its feet.
Genetic testing and health is not something that's come out of the blue. It's just curious to see what they're going to do with it by integrating all of the different strands that they're relating.
Do they have an ethics council on this, though? Because, you know, they have an ethics council for the right to be forgotten question. But it seems like more and more the implementation and the interests that Google has in different areas artificial intelligence, you know, you name it, is philosophically challenging, one. But two, the ethics of Google having access to that data about people is very questionable, isn't it?
When you're bringing up human data like this, you know, the ethics behind computer science is very different to the personal data, personal healthcare data. It's much more tightly regulated. The data path for this is Google's not actually going to get personal data. What they're going to get is anonymized kind of collection of stats and figures in correlation. So the clinical practitioner is going to take the data and be responsible for inputting the data and anonymizing that. So the ethical question is that anonymized enough? Now, it is very difficult to truly anonymize data, especially when it comes to bespoke things like health. But all these people are volunteers. They know what they're getting into. They have volunteered their services for this, and they have signed an agreement to give over their data for the pursuit of science. Now, not everybody's going to have access to this data. Only qualified scientists that have relative interests in the field are going to be able to access this data resource. And inside Google, it is ring-fenced. It is only going to be, essentially, Google is acting as the processing power hub. I mean, one of the reasons this research is happening now, one of the researchers tried 10 years ago and couldn't get it off the ground. It takes too much money. DNA sequencing has dropped. It used to cost $100,000 to sequence one person. It now costs about $1,000. And the Google's enormous computing resource that it uses for its search engine and all the rest of it, it is the holy grail of researchers. Trying to get access to a supercomputer to crunch numbers is both costly and impossible. Nine times out, yes. So frankly, Google offering this kind of service up, I mean, yes, you've got to trade it off with what does Google want from this, but you've got this enormous resource, and as long as you can ring fence the data.
Well, there is an interesting question, though, about what happens with that data. So in psychology research, there is usually a term at which the data that has been collected is destroyed to the end of the experiment. It's very, very rarely retained. However, do we have any understanding of how long this data, this health data, is going to be retained?
Not yet. You've still got to remember this is a pilot study, and they're still working out the best practices, the kind of the routine. I mean, this is very, very much in its infancy, and this is the first stage. Google was also talking about going beyond the kind of like biochemical tests you can do in the lab and fitting volunteers with wearable devices to track their health, their motion, their heartbeat, that kind of thing.
And they just so happen to have one that can be used for the trials.
Well, you know, I mean, you got to use what you've got, right?
So. Eat your own dog food.
It is interesting because it's interesting that this trend is evolving, because certainly in the US there's a lot less funding for science. In the UK there's increasingly a lot less funding for science. And so naturally people are turning to private organizations, philanthropic organizations, things like Google.org, which would potentially have done this kind of thing in the past, or Bill and Melinda Gates, which would have supplied the finance for this kind of thing. So it's curious that perhaps it's just our relationship with technology, our skepticism, our fear of technology, that sort of red flags this for us, Sam?
I think we are almost overly paranoid, and it's good to be overly paranoid, don't get me wrong, but I think people should be excited about this. Now, it's quite difficult for person on the street to understand really why this is such a great thing. Now, scientists are terrible at explaining why you should get excited about this.
Until now.
Well, basically what I want to say is that once we have a baseline for human health, we can then detect when something goes wrong. Now, when you and I go to the doctor because something is not functioning correctly, say it's a disease. That disease has been in your body for up to many years. It's already done quite a lot of damage. If you could catch it much, much earlier, A, it's easier to correct. B, it's less of a drain on the healthcare resources, because instead of treating sort of like the crash, you're preventing the crash, so there's not that aftermath. And then C, every disease that's caught by this increases the chance of something being caught further down the line. So things that we cannot cure will be spotted at a point at which we can cure it.
I'm actually genuinely surprised that this kind of thing hasn't been done before, thinking about all of the public health research that is that's in process right now. Cohort studies, so these are studies of people, you know, who are all born on a particular day or a particular year that people have been tracking for a long time. Governmental studies, whether it's in the US or in India or many of the other scientific sort of powerhouses in the world, have been doing public health science for a long time. Yet you're arguing that this is something brand new.
Well, it's not brand new. The way about they're going about it is brand new. And even then, it's not really brand new. It's just that it's got to the affordability stages that we can actually do it and do it on a scale that is useful. And so, you know, good on them, I think. I think this is the first stage of... It's the first time I've ever looked at a Google project and thought, yes, this is great for science. I really hope it's just for science. But as pure science, it is fantastic.
Bit of an incursion into science in this week's tech podcast.
Heck yeah, you pull some scientists together and who knows, they might actually start talking about science one of these days. You can follow this story at theguardian.com/technology. Uber is a classic disruptive piece of technology. It's a taxi app that's been the source of a lot of controversy this summer, with licensed taxi drivers in London protesting by grinding the center of the capital to a halt. But its metering system isn't the only thing it's upsetting. It's upending the culture of reviews, too. See, traditionally, it's just been the customer who's had the opportunity to rate a service provider, or that's what we thought. This has some very interesting far-reaching effects, of course, spreading throughout the service industry and even into government. But on Uber, customers are rated too. And a recently discovered hole in Uber's site finally offered us the ability to find out our score. Alex Hearn, you wrote about this. What happened?
Well, it's been known for a while now that Uber's drivers rank their customers in the same way as when you step out of an Uber cab, you are given the opportunity to give your driver a rating out of 5. Your drivers are given the same opportunity to give you a rating. Uber's never been entirely upfront with this. It's not like you can hit a button on the app and see your rating. They don't actually, you know, anywhere say, your driver is going to rate you at the end of this drive, so be nice. Most people who know their rating up until now knew it by asking their driver. Over the weekend, on Sunday night, a coder discovered a hole in Uber's mobile website that let you paste a little bit of JavaScript in and see your rating pop up. For a lot of people, this was the first time they even knew that they had been rated, let alone the first time they'd ever seen their rating. Interestingly, every single reported rating I saw was between 4 and 5, and I've got at least one person being told by a driver that their rating of 4.7 was a bit on the low side. So it seems likely that there's some jiggering going on with the ratings, or just that drivers are heavily encouraged not to give people low scores.
But surely this is fair enough. I mean, there was one quote from the article that you wrote for the site that came from Parker Higgins of the EFF. Passengers don't know if drivers are trained to rate consistently or whether those ratings get audited or normalized in some way. That's absolute nonsense. I have never been trained to leave a rating on Amazon, on eBay, on Airbnb. Like, it's not something Jemima looks like she's been trained.
I'm outraged.
What? That you're being rated?
Yes. Whatever happened to the customer being right? You know, you are paying them to do a service for you. And if you're rating a plumber or, I don't know, an electrician or a dentist on one of those rated review sites, is because you're trying to recommend them to someone else and trying to give them business.
Well, absolutely.
If you're the customer, how dare they rate you? I am outraged of Plumpton.
But if you get into somebody's car, right, and you are a...
And I'm a bit too pissed and I throw up, then, you know, fair enough. Maybe they could have like a tick box for might be a dodgy customer. But rating every customer, the two times I've had Uber cabs, the driver got lost the first time. I had to look the directions up on my phone. The second time, he didn't even turn up. I was waiting for 50 minutes and then he didn't turn up. So, yeah.
So you rate them badly. But if you were if that driver was coming to look for you and you didn't turn up, or if, you know, you were, I think something that you raised quite heavily in the article is sort of racism, actually.
Yeah, I'm expressing my statutory right to not use a service I was about to pay for. I'm horrified.
But for me, I mean, racism is... Discrimination, by and large, is where I think this sort of thing gets quite interesting. So the example I brought up in the piece is, you know, it's pretty well known that in London, for instance, if you live south of the river, you're going to find it hard to get a cabbie to take you there. If in New York City, you're black, you're going to find it harder to hail a cab on the street. These are, like, terrible aspects of the cab system we have right now, and ones that we would hope the march of technology and progress can slowly get rid of. The worry that I have about things like Uber's rating system is, right now, are we actually in a situation where we can guarantee that if 5 young, drunk black men get in an Uber cab, they will get out with the same rating as 5 young, drunk white women? I would not be willing to put money on those two situations coming out the same, because we live in a racist society. My question for Uber is whether or not they are taking note of this, or whether in the worst case scenario, we would wind up in a situation where we are replicating through technological means the situation that we already had before.
That's what we do anyway.
I think right, we need some scientists to do some research. You know, if only there was a way of aggregating all of this data and, you know, assessing how accurate it
so
was.
So I should say...
Get on the Google horn.
I put this to Uber, and Uber's point was twofold. Firstly, that these ratings actually are almost aesthetic. They aren't used to blacklist you. You're not going to not be picked up if you have a low rating. For Uber, these ratings are there essentially to give a driver a heads up and to provide context if there is actually a claim of serious abuse. So, for instance, if you get angry and drunk and beat up a driver...
I didn't get the chance. He didn't even turn up the second time.
But you were planning on it, Jemima, I can tell.
If you do, then Uber can look at your rating and see that actually a lot of drivers have had a bad experience with you in the past versus every other driver has reported that you were perfect and so this might be a one-off. The other thing that Uber say is that they can't really answer the question of whether or not there's any racial bias because they don't know. They don't keep that sort of data. They don't know anything about you other than your name, your phone number and your credit card details.
Well, there you go. I mean, I was actually sure that this was a service that other people. I was positive that other people did this already. Like I figured that this was in regular.
Well, you know those dodgy call centers, do you? You know they've got like a
not even the dodgy
notes field in their dodgy exactly. You know, customer relationship management software where they put no, she's really awkward. Don't phone her up.
So do they have Blast's air horn down the phone in mine?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, is that what you do?
Yeah.
I would rate you low, Sam.
Good, because I never want to be called ever.
Oh god.
I'd rate me 5.
Would you? Yeah. Out of 100?
5.
Well, do weigh in on this subject because clearly we don't have a universal opinion around this table. You can get in touch with us at GuardianTW on the Twitterverse, and you can also leave comments on the bottom of our blog post about this and read more on this story at theguardian.com/technology. Many thanks to Alex, Samuel, and Jemima for breaking news. Just go to theguardian.com/technology. And now a word from our sponsor.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
The Nether is a difficult play to stomach. Written by the LA-based author Jennifer Haley, it explores the moral implications of a high-tech society in which virtual worlds are almost lifelike and people are able, and in fact encouraged, to express some of the very darkest parts of human nature in almost real and in some cases more than real environments. I won't give too much away, but I'll say that it gets very dark very quickly. Jennifer joined us in the Tech Weekly studio before the play opened, and I began by asking her why she decided to write a technological dystopia that has, at its heart, a very disturbing soul.
I was thinking about what crime would look like if it were virtual crime, and I was thinking about the future and what about when virtual reality isn't just an idea anymore, but it's something we actually experience. I mean, there's an article that came out in The Guardian while we were rehearsing talking about how Second Life was going to start using the Oculus Rift technology. And it's kind of like, I'm telling you, this isn't science fiction. This is coming down the pipes. And what I thought about it is it could very possibly be, you know, as many web pages as there are up today by as many different authors, whether it's an individual or a corporation or government site, there could be virtual realms and people doing all kinds of things in these virtual realms. And as you also know, we have a dark net, which is kind of the underbelly of the internet. If you take special precautions, you can go into the dark net and no one can trace your identity, and all kinds of things go on there, from political dissidents use it, as well as drug traffickers and any other kind of thing that illicit trade and all kinds of stuff. So I was trying to think about combining these ideas of the dark net and virtual reality and what kind of ethical quandaries we might find ourselves in at that point.
Because ultimately what the Nether is about, it's about these ethical issues. It's about the paper-thin division between our online and our offline identities. It's about human beings rather than being about the technology. But it's about what the technology facilitates. So tell me a bit about the Nether.
So the Nether is... I was interested in trying my hand at writing a procedural for stage. I am interested in writing genre for stage. I had an earlier play that was about suburban teenagers addicted to an online horror video game. And I watched a lot of horror movies and was trying to figure out, well, how do you do this on stage? And with the Nether, I was trying to write a procedural on stage and an interrogation, write an interrogation that wasn't going to be your typical like television hackneyed interrogation, but would have a different twist to it. And so I started thinking about what we would consider unethical behavior online. And that took me to thinking about, well, what are the worst things you could do online while not committing a real crime? And that led me to pedophilia and violence against children, which was not a topic I originally thought I was going to be tackling with this, but it was one of those things. I was actually between that and, you know, virtual realm where you could commit violence against children, but no one involved was actually a child. It was all adult role play. The other thing I considered was were realms where you could commit hate crimes against other races. And I went with pedophilia because I felt like that was a little more... I think these are both hot button topics that we would be very upset about if we thought people were doing this, even in virtual realms, even if no actual people were involved or being hurt or being killed or what have you.
They're also quite universal. Certainly, you know, the hate crime mm-hmm. against people of other races it's more relative. But mm-hmm. when we're talking about pedophilia, we're talking about something that seems to be quite a universal construct that is immoral.
Yes, and as it seems in the recent headlines here, is pretty deeply embedded, I think more deeply embedded in society than we think or would like to think.
It must have taken you to some quite dark places, not just in, you know, online, but also in your own head.
Well, I'm comfortable going to dark places in my head because for me, it's kind of a mental exercise. But I wrote the first draft of it. I didn't really do too much research before writing the first draft of it. I kind of had an idea of the ethical question and I let the characters surface, you know, kind of as part of the artistic process and let the story lead me through some interesting places. Dark, yes, but once again, it's all... For me, it was the world of the imagination, which I talk about a lot in the play, and where you should be allowed to go in the world of your imagination, because obviously I didn't go to some very pretty places, and now I'm trying to share them, and you could wonder, is it, you know, how ethical is it to be producing this play? I think it's fine. I do. I'll stand by the play. But what was interesting is that... I came out of the process of the first draft and I actually started doing research after that. And when I began to find out that there were already some real world parallels going on, not necessarily in virtual reality, but in terms of stuff going on online and stuff going on in games. And you really do have to research to find this stuff. It's not at the upper level. But when I found out there were real world parallels, it's kind of like that's when I was horrified. And I'd been posing the question of how much freedom of speech are we allowed online. I consider myself a pretty big libertarian in terms of we should be, you know, free to express ourselves. And after finding out there were some real life parallels, I kind of took a step back from that. And I think that a lot of people have that reaction when they watch the play. But, you know, what I do propose in the play is that people can very well tell the difference between reality and their imagination. And, you know, there are bazillions of people playing Grand Theft Auto, but I don't think there's any evidence that that cases of people running over actual pedestrians has gone up. There is a very big difference between what you imagine doing and what you actually do. And I think I think the majority of people have that, and then there are this, and then there are a minority that do not.
At the crux, though, of the Nether are those who do not. Describe a little bit of the plot.
So the Nether begins in an interrogation room where a detective, a cyber detective, if you would like to call her that, she assumes different identities in virtual reality in order to uncover virtual crimes. The Nether at this point refers to, it's basically what the internet has become in terms of being virtual reality as opposed to simply web pages. So she's called a man named Mr. Sims in for interrogation because she's discovered he has created a realm called the Hideaway, which is a beautiful forest and a Victorian home where users can come and interact inappropriately with children. But as Sims points out, no one who actually visits there, including the children themselves, no one's actually a child. The children are played by adults, and the adults are played by adults, and he has extreme checks to make sure no one underage is admitted. So her point of view is that this is even this role play is wrong because he's created a place that is so pretty much feels like life. He's also an expert programmer, so he's kind of perfected the art of sensation. And he's created a beautiful realm at a time when the environment is so denuded that trees are rare, and it's kind of you know, it's much more pleasant to go hang out in the Hideaway than it is in the real world. And for her, that's part of the problem, that he's made it so appealing that people would rather spend time there than in the real world, and that all sense of morality starts breaking down, and that it doesn't even matter whether their actions are being transferred to the real world, that this kind of place where morality is suspended, a place of no consequence, renders us inhuman.
You mentioned that a point that you raise again and again is that you feel that it's important for people to be able to express their imaginations, to have a space to express their imaginations. I can imagine, though, that the response to the play, whether in LA, where it won an award, or here in London and across the UK, has been that people do not actually feel that imagination should be allowed in such environments, that there's a potential for danger if there are people who are more vulnerable, for example, if they're exposed to these types of ideas. Talk to me about a little bit about some of the reactions that you've had to the play. I can only imagine you've got a good spam filter.
You know, the play itself, what I wanted, I ask questions, I don't necessarily answer them. And I have found out that people come out of the play and they have a lot of questions, and questions for themselves and questions for each other, like, should this be allowed, should this not be allowed? And every once in a while, you'll find someone who's very emphatic on one side or the other. Interestingly, after the opening in LA, I had a woman come up to me, and she had been working with pedophiles in the Texas prison system, and she felt... She was really excited about the play. She felt she was glad that kind of pedophilia had been put on the table, and that there was, you know, there was a sympathetic stroke towards it too, in terms of what people are dealing with, in terms of addictions and compulsive behavior, and you know, whatever psychological baggage they're dealing with. And she felt like there was something in what the play was saying about letting people express their sexuality in a way, as opposed to not letting them express it at all, in a place where they could express it without actually hurting someone. So that was really interesting. I don't think she was exactly saying we should do this, but she appreciated the conversation around it.
Much of the play as well has to do with this, with these parallel identities as well. Tell me a little bit about how you constructed that in your own mind as you were developing the play. The idea that you have somebody who is playing somebody else, that there is almost a permeable membrane between the online and the offline self, and how to make that more or less permeable.
I think my best experience of this was, well, actually, I can go all the way back to college, that my freshman year of college, I was playing Dungeons and Dragons on Friday nights in, like, the dorm rec room. And, you know, we had to inhabit certain characters, and they actually gave me a character to be. I was supposed to be this thief, and, you know, we were running around this dungeon trying to find treasure, and I got kind of bored with the game, and I started passing notes to the dungeon master saying I wanted to steal, to pickpocket. I was a thief, so I could had a pickpocket skill. So I would pick the pockets of my fellow players until they, like, caught on. And every time I passed a note to the dungeon master, everyone would start checking their pockets. So, you know, it's, I don't even think, so now we have technology where you can have a game like World of Warcraft, and I did play World of Warcraft for a few weeks when I was working on my previous play about the suburban teenagers, and I just had the best time, and I had to stop playing because it was just taking up too much time, and it was too... I loved nothing more than getting up on Saturday morning and getting a big cup of coffee and sitting down and knowing I had hours to play this game. And it was very beautiful, it was very appealing being there, and I had this cool character, and I was working up all these levels, and I was a hunter, I had a pet, and I was playing with my friends. I mean, there were people I met in the game, but for the most part, I was playing with people I knew. I was playing with my best friend on the East Coast, and she had this kind of ridiculous-looking troll character as well. We would run around and slay things, and the level of detail in it was amazing. I mean, there was an auction house where you would go, you know, pay for things, and I would buy skins and make jerkins and go sell them back at auction again and collect gold. And I mean, it was just, and I knew I had to stop when, even when I wasn't playing, I was like making lists of things I needed to go trade at the auction house. It's like, okay, it's just a bit too much. I have too many other things I have to do and think about. But it was really fun. And it was, I felt like I was spending time with my friend when we were running around together. I felt like we were closer than we were normally, because I otherwise would only talk to her once every couple months. And I was playing this game with her every other night.
So how then do you tackle that aspect of the online closeness, the online self in the Nether? How do you deal with that when you're dealing with something that does deal with something that is so morally difficult to cope with?
So when I was writing the piece and starting to get out of, you know, I started with an ethical question, but a play that's simply about ethics is going to be really boring. So I kind of let the characters take me where they would, and what I had discovered is that you can have intimacy and friendship with someone online, even if you're playing different characters who don't look anything like you. And, you know, all of us have heard stories about marriages coming out of Second Life, and these are people who are meeting as, you know, animated characters and falling in love, and who's to say they aren't falling in love with each other because of their personalities, their basic personalities that have nothing to do with what their physical body looks like. So this idea that I also love to just scoot around the idea that technology is bad, and that spending time on too much time, obviously, but spending time online or dealing with people online or even playing these games is bad, because I don't necessarily think it is. I think there's another side to it, in that you can have friends online and you can have a good time with people and you can express yourself and you can get close and have intimacy.
Despite the obvious moral issues that are raised in this play.
Yes, and then in this play, yes, I propose that people can have serious and even somewhat beneficial emotional relationships, even in the context of violence.
Jen Haley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Alex.
The Nether by Jennifer Haley runs at the Jerwood Theatre at the Royal Court here in London until the 9th of August. We'll have a link on the blog for this podcast. That's all we have for you on this week's show. Rambunctious, wasn't it? Follow us on Twitter at GuardianTW and feel free to comment on any of the topics. Remember, for the best news, comment and features on tech, go to theguardian.com/technology. For now, from me, Alex Kratosky, and producer Jason Phipps, thank you very much for listening, and come back next week. Bye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.